This is Leader ReadyCast, a monthly podcast featuring real-world lessons, best practices, and action-oriented insights for the you're-it moments when you're called upon to lead. Leader ReadyCast is the official podcast of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, a joint program of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard John F. Kennedy School of Government. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. How do you create a culture of security, particularly when you work in an organization where the understanding of risk and security may not be widespread? And on top of that, how do you create a safe and secure environment that is welcoming to the public? While many organizations face some version of this challenge, nowhere is it felt more keenly than in a museum. Museums hold precious objects that in many cases have to be protected from light, humidity, and other environmental factors, as well as being kept physically safe, whether on display or in storage. Today, we aren't going to speak about the technical aspects of museum security. What we are going to talk about are the social and leadership challenges. How do you win hearts and minds? How do you help non-professionals bring security into their thinking? And how can a security leader fully grasp the concerns of curators, membership directors, and other peers? My guest for this episode is Anthony Amore. He's the Director of Security and Chief Investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, Massachusetts. It is absolutely one of my favorite museums, not just here in Boston, but anywhere in the world. I love being there. But in addition to that, the Gardner was the site of the most spectacular art heist in modern history. In the overnight hours of March 18, 1990, two people dressed as Boston police officers talked their way into the museum and ultimately made off with 13 major works of art, including paintings by Vermeer, Rembrandt, Degas, Manet, and more. And that incident has been documented in multiple films and in books, and to this day, it remains unsolved. It's been Amore's job to improve security, restore confidence in the institution, and help repair its reputation. That has involved a lot of meta leadership. Amore is the author of multiple books on art cons and thefts, including the most recent one, The Woman Who Stole Vermeer, The True Story of Rose Dugdale and the Rustboro House Art Heist. Anthony, welcome to Leader ReadyCast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Really great to have you here. Looking forward to this conversation. Now let's just start with a bit of your background. You were involved in the early days of the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration. It's an agency I know very well. One of my colleagues is the former administrator, and we at the MPLI have done a lot of work with them over the years. How did you come to specialize in the art world and wind up at the Gardner Museum from TSA?
That's an interesting question. When I was with the TSA, it was at Logan Airport helping to rebuild security there, and it was a real challenge to overhaul the entire look of how security was done, taking it from private industry to federal responsibility. And I had the pleasure of federalizing the screening checkpoints passengers go through, and then federalizing the baggage system, and then overseeing the regulatory compliance division and bringing that up to speed. And once I had accomplished everything I was hoping to, I saw this opportunity at the Gardner Museum, a chance to take make a real departure from trying to prevent terrorism to something unique. And I came here for my first interview and absolutely fell in love with the place. It's hard to look at it and not want to work here every day. So I jumped right into art theft and art protection work, which is pretty rewarding.
Well, that's great. And for our listeners who are not familiar with it, I urge you to go look up the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum online. It is Isabella Stewart Gardner's former home, now a museum, and it's just really a spectacular and very special place. So if you're in Boston, make sure you stop by. Now, of course, you know, everyone talks about the big theft back in 1990, and I'm assuming after that, just like after 9/11 at airports, there had to be a complete rethinking of security at the museum and probably at museums everywhere, because it's more than just bigger locks, more cameras, you know, more folks standing around in uniform. How do you as a security leader help a museum director or a board understand the full range of risks they face? You know, in meta leadership terms, we call this leading up. How do you lead up to get them on board with your vision for what this is going to be?
Well, you know, I'm glad we started by talking about my experience with TSA, because I had come from the place that was the victim of the largest terrorist attack, or at least it was launched from there. in American history and came over to the museum where the biggest property theft in world history took place. So when you're facing that sort of challenge, it comes with the fact that leadership understands how badly an institution can be burned. So I did have that as an advantage here. And I did come a number of years after the heist, but a lot of work needed to be done when I arrived on scene. It's easy to say what you do is remind the people who you answer to about what can happen when an art heist happens, especially here at the Gardner, because we have our empty frames still up on the walls. So they understand. However, one of the key elements is to make sure that the people who are making the decisions above you understand that this stuff is still happening around the world and indeed in the United States, and to explain exactly what a big problem art theft is, and really make yourself an expert in it. That's at least that's the approach I took to make sure that I knew exactly what I was talking about. So then I approached our director and our board with requests. They understood that I wasn't just guessing and I wasn't just trying to turn the museum into Logan Airport. They knew I was talking about the risks inherent to art, which are really unique.
Well, that world is so unique. And for those of our listeners who've read our book, The Year It, Crisis Change and How to Lead When It Matters Most, you may recall that one of the stories in there, one that I found particularly interesting, was of the Museum of Fine Arts here in Boston, which is just a stone's throw from the Gardner Museum. The story of Budge Upton, who was the project manager on that, the fourth project manager on that particular project, and having to navigate the politics, the egos, the different perspectives of people who are involved in a museum. Did you find these people were sort of open to and ready for what you had to say, or was there a lot of persuasion involved?
Well, that's an interesting question because I would say, from a leadership perspective, the director, the board, they and operations people completely bought into everything I had to say. It wasn't a hard sell. They respected what I had done previously. However, when you come into an institution where you're dealing with artists and curators who hold things like facility operations and security, very low on their list of priorities, that's a great challenge.
So how did you do that? How did you lead across to those peers? Because you're right, I'm sure that, again, curators have great expertise in a certain area, security not being one of them. Administrators probably the same way. And it's in what in our terms we would call the cone of the cube, where you're looking two people looking through peepholes of a cube, and looking at a cone inside. However, looking through the top, you see a circle. Looking through the side, you see a triangle, and you've got to kind of bring those perspectives together. So, how did you lead across to those folks to get them to understand you weren't their enemy, but you were there to actually improve the experience and protect the artwork?
The approach I took was, when I first began at this museum, on my first day, I started researching every art heist over the last 100+ years to see exactly how these things are done. And I now have a database that I'm still maintaining. It's got somewhere around 1,500 heists in it now. And that allows me to be able to say to a curator, what we're doing here, we should do it a different way. And when they question that, I'm able to turn around and say, for example, I could say, well, in 2015, in this similar situation, here's how a painting was robbed or damaged or defaced intentionally. So being able to give real world examples of these things, which happen quite frequently, really brings it home for someone who typically never thinks about security. And the one thing that curators do have that I like to take advantage of in a good way is that they love the art. So if you can make it clear to them that your only goal is to protect that art and preserve it and keep it safe and keep their reputation intact, by the way, because often they're borrowing art on loans from other institutions, if you get that point across, then they tend to listen.
That's great. So you're playing expert to expert, and so complementary expert areas of expertise to bring to bear there, because you're right, curators do love the art, and That makes you an ally, not an adversary, one hopes, when you can show that you love it as well and you care about it as much as they do.
Well said. That's exactly right.
Now, one of the challenges, and this is part of why we asked you to be on the program, is that museums are facing a lot of pressure now to be more open. There's financial pressure to make sure your visitor numbers are up. There's social pressure to make sure that you're welcoming to the broader community. And I know the Garden is not alone in hosting social events beyond sort of the standard viewing hours. Yet today we're seeing not only potential theft, but we're seeing protesters symbolically defacing museum exhibits, in addition to the normal run-of-the-mill threats you might face. How do you balance the need for accessibility with the equally pressing need to preserve and protect that art that's on display?
Well, that's the key, in all facets of security. But like you said, museums, it's particularly challenging because we take our most valuable items and we think about how to optimize accessibility to them, which is the opposite of, say, what a bank or a jewelry store would do, right? So we try to make sure people can really have an unobstructed view of a painting. In my museum, it's especially challenging because the founder's will says we can't change anything. So you mentioned the MFA across the street. If there's an object that's getting touched too frequently by visitors, say they can move it, whereas we can't. So I spend a lot of time exploring technology that that can keep an eye on objects or paintings without being visible to the visitors, so that they don't feel obstructed in approaching them. One of the really interesting things, though, that I talk about when I talk about museum security is that there's great technology out there. Since 9/11, as you know, it skyrocketed to, unbelievable proportions and, frankly, affordability. But what is really interesting in the museum world is just how effective a stanchion is. A good old-fashioned stanchion, even if it's not a very high one, even if it's almost at shin level, for some reason, thankfully, the public respects those and observes them. They don't have to be obtrusive. So I guess my greater lesson there is you can't just be wedded to the latest and greatest technology. You have to think about what things have worked in the past. And one thing museums have, museum security people have, that's an advantage, is a team of conservators who work on repairing and preserving and protecting art as well. So I'm able to collaborate with them on ways that we can protect things that won't hinder the visitor experience. That being said, you mentioned environmental protesters, and that's a really big risk. And you might know that we were the first museum targeted by environmental protesters in the United States. And I had anticipated that because I was looking at what they were doing in Europe. And they were obviously, and it's no surprise, targeting the most iconic pieces. It's not an accident that they went after the Mona Lisa or the girl with the pearl earring or the Rokeby Venus. When the first museum they targeted was us, and it was exactly as I thought that they would target our empty frames, because they're so iconic. We were able to get out ahead of them coming here, and one of the things we've implemented is a bag search at our entrance now, because we know what these protesters are bringing into museums around the world, and that's what we target. And one of the challenges is making sure mission creep doesn't affect your employees, where they, you tell them to look for one thing, and they're stopping people from bringing 10 other unrelated objects to the museum. But that's one of the quick adjustments we made, and it's very not obtrusive. And we've not received a single complaint from a visitor. And we have a lot of visitors at the Gardner. We have a very robust attendance rate.
No, that's great. Anyway, I'm listening to you speak. I'm thinking about you must have some an almost daily calibration of sort of how visible do you make the security, how unobtrusive do you make it, where do you make it obtrusive, as you say, and implementing a bag search, a small intrusion on the visitor, but really important if somebody is trying to smuggle in cans of paint to throw on empty frames, or heaven forbid, throw on a piece of art. But that must be a really interesting dial to move back and forth to figure out when do you make it visible as a deterrent, when do you make it less visible so you're sure to be out of the way in order to achieve that the right balance of protecting the institution and what it holds, yet making everything accessible to the many, many, many people who come to visit the Gardner.
Yes, and our museum is special in that way. We're not an encyclopedic museum, and by that I mean we're not just blue walls with paintings hanging on them. Everything in our galleries is a collection piece, from the wall coverings to the floor. So if I want to install a new camera, I have to work with the curatorial staff to, for its appearance. Where can I put it? If I have new wires installed, will they be, will that require drilling into an ancient fabric, that sort of thing? And, we don't do that. So it's very challenging, but one of the things I do try to do is make sure that some, I'm not letting the cat out of the bag. And just one example, we have a live set of eyes in every gallery. So we don't reply, I'm sorry, depend on CCTV solely. We have a live guard in every room watching, and that's an important deterrent. And there are things that come along with that in terms of accessibility. I know from my research that distracting a guard during the daytime is a method that thieves use in stealing art, especially small pieces. So I don't allow my guards to engage in protracted conversations with visitors. And sometimes a visitor might think they're being a little terse with them. So we have to be prepared to train our people in those soft skills so that they can deflect people seeking conversations effectively without being distracted from keeping their eyes on the art. My experience in the TSA is actually helpful in this because I did a lot of research into how long can a person watch a monitor and still be effective. You have your X-ray security people watching that screen, and how long can they reasonably be expected to watch that screen and start to see their attention diminish? And we know that about our guards who are watching our cameras. So that's why I think it's so important to have a human being in every room watching the art as well in real time.
Absolutely. And that's, in meta leadership terms, we talk about leading down, and that's great, developing people with those appropriate soft skills. Because you're right, I'm sure you get people who come in and they want to chat, most of whom just want to chat because it's they have questions, but some people could be up to something nefarious, and giving people those skills is critical. That's very good to hear. Now,
Absolutely,
go
absolutely
ahead.
right. In my research, I found that more than half of museum thefts happen while the place is open. So that's a
Wow.
really, really important way for me to be able to justify the things we do during the daytime.
Again, that's really interesting, and I it guess in some ways it makes sense because if you've got strong perimeter security when you're closed, you have to get through that before you can get to the yard. If you can walk in the front door, that's one barrier you've overcome, and then to go try and do something bad beyond that, that's really interesting.
You said it well. That's exactly right. We're a fortress at night. But during the daytime, our goal is to get people in near priceless objects. And that is a unique challenge that I welcome, of course. But it's a security, it can be a security nightmare when you get a museum that's too crowded. You have a lot of bric-a-brac. Everybody thinks about paintings, but they forget about these small objects on tables or furniture that you don't want it to get kicked. It's very delicate. So all of these things come into play.
Now, let's talk a bit about leading beyond to external stakeholders. And here I'm thinking of the public, I'm thinking about the media. You think about, I'm not sure if you really have any regulatory bodies involved, but who are the external stakeholders you work with most closely, and how do you think about leading them?
Well, that's a. I'm glad you asked that question because we're in a unique position here at this museum because we did have this major theft, and people are still curious about it 34 years later, very curious. And the media spends a lot of time seeking interviews with me to speak about the missing painting. So you do have to think to yourself, I am constantly talking to the public about a theft that happened here. So I think it's important to make sure that I get the message out about just how robust our security system is today and how seriously we take it. So the media can be an asset in that endeavor in getting public confidence in an institution. I know this museum so intimately, and people who are museum goers do, but the average person hears that a museum is robbed, and that just sticks in their head forever, and they think there must be poor security. In fact, one of the challenges I face is that there's a myth that one of the reasons we were robbed in 1990 is because our museum had notoriously bad security. And that's just not true. We have the same security every other museum had. So getting that sort of message out there is important so that people know, yes, there was a major theft here, but every museum, say here in Massachusetts, every museum with a Rembrandt had been robbed before we were. It's something that happens. We were not particularly bad, but we are very, very serious today about making sure that we're never a victim again. So that message is important to get out to the public. Another external stakeholder that I think about that is most people don't is our surrounding institutions. My museum is surrounded by colleges and universities on three sides. And I think a lot about being a good neighbor to them. We have extensive camera coverage in this museum, including outside, I mean, world class. And the institutions around us often turn to us for help about incidents that happen on their campuses because we can see them. And being a good neighbor pays dividends. Each one of these institutions has a police department that helps us when we need them. They respond very quickly. So that those external stakeholders, our immediate neighbors, are people that I care a heck of a lot about. And it's an important way to keep us safe as well.
That's great. I hadn't thought about that, but that's a, again, knowing the geography there, that's a really good set of partnerships to have, and I'm glad you're nurturing them. Now, thinking across all this, the work you've done at the Gardner, the work you've done at TSA, and the rest of your career, are there one or two leadership lessons you've learned that are particularly relevant to the work of other safety and security leaders in settings beyond museums and beyond the airports? How have you made security a welcome participant at the table, not simply a concern that must be tolerated or addressed?
The first example I learned was, or lesson I learned was with the TSA, and I brought it over here to the museum, and that is the importance of what you just mentioned with stakeholders. When we rebuilt security at Logan Airport in tandem with Massport, the governing organization there, we held a daily meeting every day at 8:30 for all the security stakeholders, from the airlines, the vendors, the airport itself, and from the government, and making sure that, as we would say, you're not exchanging business cards on the day something bad happens. And that is the key here, even inside a medium-sized museum, is making sure everybody who works here understands what we do, why we do it. We don't take a hardline approach with people. We don't carry a heavy fist. We don't pretend we're police in any way. We're just professional with people. And that's one of the approaches we treat everyone in the museum with respect. I think, again, museums have an unusual group of people who work within them. Their skill sets are different than you would find, say, at Fidelity or even at a college or university. So making sure that people who work in the arts understand that we respect them and we want to keep them safe as well, not just the art, is an important leadership lesson, I think. A second one is when I worked at the airport, I had 1,200 employees. Here, I have anywhere from 50 to 60 at any given time. And I think a really important thing I learned from Admiral George Nakara, who was my boss at TSA, was getting out of your office and speaking to your people, no matter how big your staff is, and letting them know that you really do care about them, not just showing face and pretending, slapping them on the back once in a while, but really getting out there and listening to them and talking to them about what they do. Museum security guards don't have a lot of challenges, right? Don't use flash in your camera. Don't touch that. Don't use a pen, et cetera. But the ones they do are vitally important. And when we hire them, I explain to them in very detailed manner. You may think that your job is just to stand around and look at art, but one slip up, and you can become famous really quickly. And all you have to do is look at our history here in 1990. Everybody knows the name of the guard who let the bad guys in by mistake. You don't want to be that person, So you do have an important job. One slip up can mean the loss of a $100 million painting. So I just try to make sure they feel necessarily. What they're doing is very, very important. And I think that leadership lesson I learned at TSA, the last part of that is I've been here 18 and a half years and we've suffered no losses of any sort. And I make it clear to my staff that they're the ones that have done that. I might put the stuff in motion, but they're the ones that are out in the galleries every day. So that success hinges solely on them. And I let them know how appreciative of that I am. So I think those have been useful, but there's always room for improvement.
Yeah, I think those are great takeaways, and that every morning meeting at Logan Airport still happens. I think it may have moved a little bit earlier, but I know it still happens every day. I've attended it a couple of times, and it is those kind of meetings are great for communicating across those organizational boundaries and making sure everybody feels like they're on the same team and that they're sharing the same information. And then your talk about what you've done with your staff of connecting them to the mission. Again, I think I've seen that anytime I've seen a successful safety and security culture, people are connected to that larger mission, or they understand the importance of the small things they may do every single day, and how much is riding on it. And I know I've talked to again people at TSA at Logan who are checking bags, and it's like whenever I see a one of them said to me, whenever I see a plane take off safely, I know I've done my job well. And getting people to really understand how connected they are to that larger mission is so important to keeping them motivated and getting to a good result.
Eric, what you just said really heartens me because when I was at TSA when it began, we were hiring well over 1,000 new employees. I would swear them in. And I would tell them in a little speech that this is a job where people are not going to say thank you. For the most part, people are not going to say thank you for what you're doing. A few might, but you're going to get very few thanks from the public. But you have to remember that every time a parent gets on that airplane with their child, they're thanking you. They're expressing that their confidence in what you're doing. And you have to look at those as thank yous. Try to remember back to September 12th. Nobody wanted to fly. So, that's where you find your fulfillment in the fact that people trust you enough to get on those airplanes.
That's great. I'm glad that's continued all the way through. So my final question for you is the one I ask all of my guests. Yes, you've been through a lot. You've been through TSA after 9/11. You came into the Gardner a bit after that big heist. You've had to fix some things. So what gives you hope?
I have a very recent example for you. I mentioned earlier that the environmental activists targeted us twice, and we were able to stop them twice. We're the only museum in the world that has stopped these people. And what gives me hope is that when these things happen, an unusual thing in 2024 is that 100% of the public is behind us. I don't care if you look on Reddit, where you see a rowdy crowd, if you look on comment sections of the newspaper, if you look on other social media, you will see that when we closed because environmental activists were coming here, people supported us without exception. When we do bag searches now, people come in and they say, and they literally say, we understand why you're doing this. So I feel hope in the fact that people understand the importance of what we're doing. We're not just spinning our wheels and we're not just protecting, worthless items. People understand it. And it's so hard to find consensus in the world nowadays, but in this, there's absolute consensus. And that really gives me hope for the future of protecting museums.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Anthony.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure, Eric. Thank you.
My guest for this episode has been Anthony Amore. He's the Director of Security and Chief Investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. Until next time, remember that you're it. Be ready to lead when it matters most. This has been another episode of Leader ReadyCast from the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and find out more about us at npli.sph.harvard.edu. Follow us on Twitter at HarvardNPLI. Thanks for listening, and be ready to lead.